Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Charles Frazier, the acclaimed author of Cold Mountain, 13 Moons, and Nightwoods. And today he's going to talk with us about his brand new book, Verena, and the joys of writing it, the joys of finishing it, and the fun and other aspects of traveling around talking about his book all over the country. Charles Frazier, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about you have to tell us a lot. Tell us some things about Verena.
Well, I never wanted to write about the Civil War again after Cold Mountain. I thought that's done. Don't want to revisit that. And I hadn't for 20 years. But I ran across a few – I wasn't looking for it. I just ran across some interesting facts about Verena. That, for example, she shortly after Jefferson Davis died in 1899, he'd been working on his memoirs. She finished the memoirs for him, packed up her bags, and moved to New York City. She was 61.
Where were they living?
Biloxi.
Uh-huh.
She was 61. She said, going to New York to be a writer. And she was she wrote for several years for the New York World. Did columns, did a like a an advice column, a sort of a Dear Abby kind of thing. She made a good portion of her living for a while as a journalist. There's a recent scholarly article that talks about her as a kind of groundbreaking woman journalist in the world of New York newspapers. That was interesting. Then I found out that in New York, she lived there for the rest of her life. After she got settled in, she became friends with Julia Grant, the widow of Ulysses S. Grant. And Southern newspapers were outraged that she had moved to New York. They were outraged that she became friends with Julia Grant. She said the right side won the war. She and Julia Grant would go on carriage rides in Central Park and be seen together in restaurants, and they wanted to be seen together as an example of reconciliation.
Well, that's interesting. This was at that particular moment in history. It was at a time where there was sort of a reconciliation among the white peoples of the United States, welcoming back the South, and at the same time an effort in the Southern states that we've learned more and more about recently to impose another, if not a slave society, something close to it.
Yeah, the failures of Reconstruction, and then the Jim Crow era that when most of the Confederate monuments were erected, not right after the war, but during that period.
Do you have any sense of how Verena felt about this breaking up of Reconstruction? Her Southernness would say that this is really a good thing that the white people are asserting their right to rule. And then you say she was kind of a liberal in some respects.
Well, yeah, she would say one day something pretty progressive for the time, or do something pretty progressive for the time, like sit in a hotel lobby for quite a while talking to Booker T. Washington about education, which made all the newspapers in New York and in the South as well. And she would say the right side won the war, those sorts of things. And then a week later she would say something that some nostalgic thing about the way things used to be. But the thing that intrigued me about her, I mean, she never reached a position that we would look at now and find a kind of perfect position. But she was moving. She was changing her opinions. She was at a time when a lot of people – a time in life when a lot of people are just getting more and more entrenched in their past and, oh, gosh, it was so great back then. She was trying to move forward and to live in the present world that she found herself in. I think some of that she lived in London good stretches of time after the war, sometimes by herself, and then moving to New York. I think her sense of the world and being able to separate from the culture she grew up in was something that was happening to her. And I was very interested in that attempt late in life to keep moving forward.
I wondered, and I had an opinion, but I still wondered whether she was likable in any respect. Did people like her, or was she sort of a putting off person who and really liked to be alone rather than be surrounded?
She loved parties, dinners. She loved Washington, D.C. Back before the war, nothing pleased her more than to – I mean, she was going to parties and dinners at the White House when she was 18 years old and kind of surprising some of the people there with how much she knew. She was very well educated. She wrote about when she was 18 going to something and talking to a famous scientist, the vice president of the United States, and somebody else about literature. And she said something like, they were certainly fishing in shallow waters, but they kept casting.
Well, maybe we can come back to later life. But yeah. The story of Verena Davis, the second wife of Jefferson Davis, doesn't begin in Washington or in New York or in London. It begins back in Mississippi where she and Davis grew up.
Yeah.
They weren't high school sweethearts.
No. He was twice her age when they met, more than twice her age. She was 17. It felt to me, I mean, the way I interpreted it is that it was, in a sense, an arranged marriage.
How do you mean?
Well, her father had come to Mississippi from New Jersey. His father, her grandfather, was a 8-term governor of New Jersey, but they voted every year back then. So, I took it as if he was a younger son, that he didn't have that many prospects up there, and that he thought, you know, I'll move from New Jersey to Mississippi, and I can't help but be the smartest guy there and make a fortune. And he turned out not to be the smartest guy there and married a rich Mississippi woman. But he lost all his money and he lost all his wife's money and they were bankrupt when she was a teenager. So she went from going to all the best parties in Natchez, which was a pretty fancy city then, to not being very not being a very desirable match anymore.
She didn't bring any cows to the,
exactly.
to the marriage.
Yeah. So her husband, her father just announced to her one day, your education is over now. She was 17. So you've gotten a wonderful invitation from Joseph Davis, the older brother of Jefferson Davis, to come up there and stay and visit. And you'll be there for about 3 months. And Joseph Davis had a huge plantation, like 7,000 or 8,000 acres, and Jefferson had a smaller one right beside it. It just felt like they were setting him up with her, because he was coming out of almost a decade of mourning for his first wife and was wanting to get into politics. Somebody in Mississippi related to politics, I can't remember who, said he has all the tools to be a successful politician except that he lacks a hostess. And I feel like Verena was sent at 17 up there to become the hostess.
Well, did Jefferson Davis happily fall for this offering? Did he take the bait?
He did, yeah. She was a pretty good horse rider, and he was a really good horse rider. And they would, when they first met, they would go out on horses and just, you know, race and jump fallen trees and that kind of thing. And she was smart and could talk books with him. And within a matter of a couple of months, they were ready to get engaged.
Did she not have any reservations about marrying an older man? Gone to heaven?
There's a really great letter she writes to her mother at that time when she says, "At times he seems young and at times he seems old, but he must be old because he's about your age."
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Charles Frazier about his latest book, Barina. That's a novel of historic fiction, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. If you join us late, this is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Charles Frazier, who's visiting in Chapel Hill in connection with the recent release of his latest book, Barina. I want to keep on talking about Barina, but can we talk just a little bit about the book?
Sure.
How's the book doing?
Well, it's on the New York Times bestseller list.
Did you learn this right after the book came out, or did it take a week or two?
It was a few days.
Uh-huh.
And I was on a train from Seattle to Portland, and got a text, and my daughter, who's traveling with me and kind of taking care of communications with the publisher, wrote them back and said, Dad's response was, "Well," which but, means he's elated.
Well, it's got to be, even for an author like yourself who's got successes on his belt, after working 5 years on this book, to at least make the New York Times bestseller list. That it's not a flop.
Yeah, that's
and now we see what happens next. Yeah. But that's got to be – so all you said was, "Well," yeah. What were you thinking? Were you worried – did you anticipate that it would move to the this is not an automatic thing, even for famous writer.
It's difficult subject matter, and I was aware of that going in, that I've never been interested in Jefferson Davis, and particularly the past few years. Jefferson Davis is, with statues being taken down and all that, and how to deal with him in the book was a matter that I thought about a whole lot all the way through. What I was interested in was that the Civil War just doesn't seem to want to let go of us or us of it or both, that those issues that led to the war, that caused the war, and the aftermath of the war, we're still seeing. And when I was working on this book, sitting down every day to work, so often something like the church shootings in Charleston or the violence in Charlottesville was right there, reminding me that the aftermath of this war is not done yet, and largely because we've never reconciled those issues that caused it.
And so, how did this story pull you out of your promise to yourself never to write about the Civil War again, and the context of the current or our ongoing racial divide in our country?
Well, Verena felt like a nuanced, complicated character. Not a hero when I started the book. I didn't see her as a hero when I finished the book. I saw her as a really interesting way to write about the sort of the consequences of being on the wrong side of history. So that's what kept pulling me through the writing of this book is thinking about those issues every day.
The book is the story is told in an interesting way, and you bring a character who was a real character but one that you loaded up with a lot of your own someone who becomes a major character in your book.
Yeah, the character who, when he's young, is called Jimmy Limber. It was a nickname because he was double jointed. Is real. James Blake, the grown up Jimmy Limber, is imagined. It was one of the things I ran across early, had no idea of. It felt so unlikely.
What is
that? There's a picture of a about five year old child, multiracial, living in the Confederate White House alongside Jefferson Davis's children. And when Verena Davis left Richmond 3 days before the fall and burning of Richmond, she took Jimmy Limber with her. He was with her all the way until she was captured in South Georgia, was taken away, and about a year after that, he disappears from history.
That's the historical fact.
Yeah.
But it was a historical fact that Mrs. Davis brought into the White House of the Confederacy a black or mixed-race child who's African-American and really treated him as part of the family, or was he just sort of a pet?
That's a question. Some people in Richmond use that kind of terminology. Other people didn't. So that becomes part of what the grown-up imagined version of him wants to know is, you know, what was I? Why was I there? He just remembers flashes of that time of his life. His memory isn't really complete until he's 7 or 8. And he's asking her about that. Why was I there?
How did they happen to meet again?
I just imagine she frequently, once her finances were a little better off late in life, would spend the summer or part of the summer in resorts in upstate New York. So I have her in Saratoga Springs, and he is in Albany and reads that she's up there, and he goes up to ask, are these memories of mine real? And that leads to 7 Sundays of he comes to visit on Sunday and they talk.
So this is the way you – this is not an unusual, but this is an interesting way to organize the story, is that the visits of James Blake, who may or may not be, but probably is, as we learned, the Jimmy Limber, the little black kid that the Davises adopted, as they remember – and discover their memories. That's the way the story. That's the way you tell the story.
Yeah, that's the present time of the book is 1906, and he's learning about his life. She's going back, remembering, reevaluating her life, and week by week, as he gets to know her better and more comfortable with her, he gets bolder in challenging her about some of the elements of her life.
One of the poignant memories that that establishes credibility is that he remembers the death of one of Mrs. Davis's or Verena's real children.
Yeah,
and I guess that was historical as well. When and how did you decide to incorporate that event in the story?
I was up in Richmond, going around that house. And I knew that one of her little boys, who was about the same age as Jimmy Limber, had fallen off a balcony and died. Fell off a balcony onto cobblestones and died. And got the person leading the tour to take me out there and show me exactly where it would have been and that sort of thing. And was just thinking about that personal tragedy, that personal trauma in the middle of that huge historic period of death and destruction and loss.
If you joined us a little bit ago, I'm visiting with Charles Frazier, of course the author of Cold Mountain and now the author of Verena, his latest book. He and I will be right back to talk some more about that book. Thank you. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Charles Fraser, author of Cold Mountain, two other wonderful books, 13 Moons and Night Woods, and now Verena. And we're talking about Verena. It's, if you did join us late, this is a book. It's historical fiction, but it's centered on the life and experience of Mrs. Jefferson Davis, whose given name was Verena. Going back to Cold Mountain, I know you want to. You're not all that excited about talking about Cold Mountain, but the real drama in the new book Verena happens on the road, yeah. And there is a struggle to get from Richmond into Charlotte and then down into South Carolina and hopefully all the way to Havana. And there are adventures that take place. I mean, is that the way you like to tell stories, is that you get these people on the road and have them encounter characters along the way?
Well, I love that kind of book, all the way back to, you know, Don Quixote or something. Just get people in motion and things happen. And it really intrigued me that she when she left Richmond, it was by train, but, 3 days before the fall of Richmond. And she made it to Charlotte by train, and when she got to Charlotte, there was an angry mob waiting at the train station, threatening to just come onto the train. And I mean, it's a very angry group.
You know, this was, excuse me for interrupting you, but this was a moment in the story that made me wonder that at the end of the Civil War, there would be in the South not a resentment against the Yankees, but a resentment against their own government that had been defeated, and so they're not loyal Confederates, are they?
I think the anger there was just being led into this disastrous war, and once it was absolutely clear that it was done and lost, and a lot of people had lost a lot of family, lost property, lost a lot. That there was this frustration and anger, and going to take it out on whatever figure that represented the Confederate government.
Today, the Confederate loyalists blame General Grant, General Sherman, mm-hmm. and the Yankees for their loss, rather than blaming blaming Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee and the others who took us into the war. But so the crowd, the anger of the crowd, as you describe it, was a surprise for me, or it was a learning point.
It was for me too, especially the threat of violence that minute. And she was on a train. There were only two men with her, and when that started happening, the two men realized they only had one pistol between them. And one guy who was a Navy officer had a sword, and they were thinking, we're going to have a hard time holding these people off with one pistol and one sword.
How did they get out of that?
The crowd worked their anger out in yelling and screaming and throwing stuff at the train.
Then what did they do?
Well, they couldn't find a place. Nobody would take them in Charlotte. And they had a hard time finding a place to stay for a day or two. Finally, somebody – they were afraid of repercussions when the Northern Army came. They finally found somebody who would take them in. And then shortly after that, railroad bridges were being blown up going south, and they were in wagons and horses and camping out essentially for a lot of the time.
How did you find out about her experiences on the road? And how much in addition did you have to make up to make it a great story?
Well, I got the route fairly well laid out, because towns where they stayed or passed through were mentioned either in their journals or particularly in the journals of John Wood, who was with Jefferson Davis's group, who were coming along behind them. And he kept a little pocket journal all the way down every night where they camped, how many miles they'd gone, what towns they'd gone through. It's here in the library at Chapel Hill. So I got a lot of detailed sense mm-hmm. of that route through that journal.
And how did the population react to these travelers?
In places, they were welcomed mainly by, like in a town like Abbeville, South Carolina. It's still there, a big, beautiful plantation-looking house. It's right at the edge of town. That was owned by somebody who had a stake in the Confederacy and in the slave economy, and he welcomed them and gave them a place to stay and rest for a couple of days. But a lot of times, they were kind of trying to be careful not to be recognized.
Why?
Well, because for one thing, they became fugitives.
They had a price on their head.
Yeah, yeah. One of the few men who remained with her throughout the trip was Burton Harrison, Jefferson's private secretary, and he was charged with treason and imprisoned in the North for a while after the war. So they were afraid of the consequences of being caught. I mean, Verena was wanted too.
And why was she wanted? What was her crime?
I don't know whether they never fully charged her with anything. I don't know whether they were just wanting to scare her and get information or what. But she was under house arrest in Savannah for several months after she was captured.
When she finally did get caught. Along the way, you mentioned that some people thought that they were carrying away all of the Confederacy's extra money.
Yeah. Yeah, that mysterious Confederate gold that supposedly disappeared. There was a point in the book where I was going to make the Confederate gold a bigger part of it.
You were going to make it real.
Did you,
I'm off topic and just forgive me, but did you ever come to an opinion about whether or not there really was a lot of gold in the Confederacy?
I became convinced that it was that there was never one big chunk of it. That it came from different mints, little bits. They were even sweeping up the floors of the various mints to get slivers of silver and gold. It was real that there was some silver and gold. The amount's another matter. But a lot of it got they stopped in Washington, Georgia, and tried to pay off some of the people that were on their way home, just give them part of their back pay. I don't think there was a whole lot left after Washington, Georgia.
A lot of times on a book, you try to sort it out and think, is this a book about – is this a character study or is this an adventure study – adventure story?
Well, the thing was her life gave me both of those things, because that adventure story is there. It's real for whatever it was, about 6 weeks, 7 weeks, something like that before she was captured. That's how she was living. She went from being first lady of a essentially fake country to being a fugitive. And they were traveling pretty rough a lot of that time. She calls that period the axle of her life, that everything turns around. And I use that in the book because this book's not done chronologically. I used it as a place where the readers know, okay, we're back in 1865 and we're on the camping
trip.
We're
on the road.
Yeah, on the road.
Even though it's in the you get it in chunks mixed in with other stories as well. Well, was that hard for you to keep straight, or did you have to have a big chart to keep the?
Well, I was keeping it straight in my head, but at some point in the last year of working, I realized I needed to help the reader out some in following these shifts in time, and there were small things that may be more subliminal, like the 1906 stuff is in present tense. You always know when you get back to the fugitive stuff. There are dates between most of the major divisions and that kind of thing. I tried to make sure that all of those you could follow.
I wondered, and you know the story so well, and you don't need those markers because you know where you are, whether your editor was helpful to you in that, or did you just realize that yourself?
Yeah. I I like to read a meter reader halfway at least, and so that was what I was trying to do there, is not make it too daunting to thread your way through.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Charles Frazier. We're talking, the author of Cold Mountain, talking about his latest book, Verena. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Charles Frazier. He is promoting his latest book, Verena. And for those of you who may have come along late in life, he's known throughout the world as the author of the wonderful classic book, Cold Mountain. In terms of the messaging, comparing Verena and Cold Mountain as a commentary on race, on the war, do you feel the same way that you did in Cold Mountain, or have you progressed, or have you moved a little bit along the way that, and this book is describing your new feelings, or is this just another way in which you say you guys have gotten to be slaves to the Civil War, and the Civil War really was a very tough thing?
Well, I certainly hope I've progressed in my thinking and have tried to. But one thing I'm proud about Cold Mountain is that it did not idolize the generals. Inman views figures like Lee and Longstreet and Stonewall Jackson with a great deal of cynicism. He does not, by the end of the war, he does not see them as heroes. And I was looking at that war through the lens of a farmer from the southern Appalachians going off to fight this thing and coming back totally disillusioned about the reasons the war was fought. So that part I like the way that that feels now.
Do either of these books deal specifically in your mind with the racial challenges that our country has faced all along, but that are sort of special in these current times?
Well, if you look at the way the past few years have been, and it just feels to me like there's been, I don't know whether it's a resurgence of racism or just people feeling more entitled to say it, that stuff they've been feeling all along the past few years have given them the freedom to express it. It just feels like something has changed, and it may just be that, the ability to say it aloud. When I was in school here, I thought this would all be long since done with. And it's very, very depressing to find that it's not. But a lot of the time working on this book, I thought of the history of race, slavery, the aftermath of the Civil War, like that framework, the armature inside a sculpture, that thing that you build it around, and then it's kind of baked into the shape. And sometimes it felt like that the legacy of race in this country is like that armature that we haven't been able to change the shape.
It's our framework in your mind, that all of the stuff at the edges doesn't change that basic fundamental sculpture.
Yeah.
We've got just a few minutes left, and I know every place you stop, people want to know how you write. How do you order your life?
Yeah.
It's no author does it exactly the same. What are your rules of how to work and how to get a book out?
Well, when I'm really working, I work 7 days a week, because when I take a day off, then it's hard to get going again. And if I take 3 days off, it's really hard to get going again. So I try to work every day. And I don't ever feel creative until about 3 in the afternoon. which is not convenient when, you know, supper time, things like that. But it's the way it works for me, and I've just accepted it.
Well, what do you do when you're working? I know, you know, some of it is writing, but
yeah.
What you got? Some of it's research. How does it all break down?
I mean, I do the research a lot in the mornings, especially early on in a book. I'll do that in the morning, then I'll write some in the afternoon. As I get into a book, the writing takes up a bigger chunk of time, and the research becomes a smaller portion, but I'm doing the research all the way to the end.
And how are you writing? Are you writing on your computer?
Yeah.
And when do you? In what way do you revise your writing? Do you wait till you finish the book and do you just?
I don't write front to back. I write pieces, especially the first year or so. I'm very self-indulgent the first year. I follow any, you know, wild goose chase that comes up.
Are you writing then for fun? Is that fun?
Well, it can be. Uh-huh. It's just this sort of constant, what could happen? And I'll try it. And a lot of that gets thrown away. Later, I get much more disciplined, and I'm really pretty disciplined about throwing stuff out, even if I love it.
At what point in that process do you have enough of the – pieces there to sit down and write the framework or the outline of the way you're going to start pulling these pieces in and finding new writing that you have to – at what point do you really know exactly how this book is going to be
organized?
Well,
it starts happening after the first year. Then I'm seeing the pieces I've got and seeing which ones work and which ones don't. And I start shaping it after about a year, and finding the sequences that go together, sequences that need to be separated. By the third year, then I've beginning to get a sense of a beginning and a maybe not exactly an ending, but a progression. By then, and then a lot of times finding the ending, I'll write three or four different endings and think about how to do it.
So we won't look for another book from you for another 5 years. And maybe not even then because you haven't started on it, maybe.
Well, I actually have.
Really?
I never have before. Usually I dither around for a year trying to figure out what's next. But I've got two ideas that I've done research and have about 10,000 words apiece.
Well, give us a clue.
Two ideas. One of them is set partly during the Depression and partly during the 1970s. And that one
in the South.
Part of it's in the Southern Appalachian. Part of it's in that high prairie part of western Nebraska, eastern Wyoming, an area that I spent a certain amount of time in over the years.
And what's the other idea?
Well, the other one,
just a little bit, a hint.
It's got to do with Asheville and a famous writer. So,
oh my gosh!
We'll
okay,
see. Well, there have been a lot of famous writers. Through
yeah,
Asheville
but I mean, but
years.
I can imagine the one that I think you're working on, and I won't get you to check it because you're not going to tell me. But Asheville and a famous writer. Yeah, we can get to that. Are you having fun selling the book? Or traveling around and talking to on your book tour.
Yeah.
Or is that just a chore?
No. I mean the getting on an airplane every morning is a chore. But going to bookstores I've known for years and years, or going to new independent bookstores, I love talking to the bookstore people and the readers who come. That part I really enjoy every day of that.
Thank you for your book, and thanks so much for sharing these comments with us. We wish you all the continued success with this book, and we're already waiting for a book set in Asheville and Great Plains, or in Asheville and a famous writer.
Thank you.
Thanks to Charles Frazier. Thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.